the scientific and practical necessity of giving due consideration to feeling. Healing the split. Our intellect has created a new world that dominates nature and has populated it with monstrous machines. The latter are so indubitably useful that we cannot see even a possibility of getting rid of them or our subservience to them. Man is bound to follow the adventurous promptings of his scientific and inventive mind and to admire himself for his splendid achievements. At the same time, his genius shows the uncanny tendency to invent things that become more and more dangerous because they represent better and better means for wholesale suicide. In view of the rapidly increasing avalanche of world population, man has already begun to seek ways and means of keeping the rising flood at bay. But nature may anticipate all our attempts by turning against man his own creative mind. The H-bomb, for instance, would put an effective stop to overpopulation. In spite of our proud domination of nature, we are still her victims, for we have not even learned to control our own nature. Slowly, but it appears inevitably, we are courting disaster. There are no longer any gods whom we can invoke to help us. The great religions of the world suffer from increasing anemia because the helpful noumena have fled from the woods, rivers, and mountains, and from animals, and the godmen have disappeared underground into the unconscious. There we fool ourselves that they lead an ignominious existence among the relics of our past. Our present lives are dominated by the goddess Reason, who is our greatest and most tragic illusion. By the aid of reason, so we assure ourselves, we have conquered nature. But this is a mere slogan, for the so-called conquest of nature overwhelms us with the natural fact of overpopulation and adds to our troubles by our psychological incapacity to make the necessary political arrangements. It remains quite natural for men to quarrel and to struggle for superiority over one another. How, then, have we conquered nature? As any change must begin somewhere, it is the single individual who will experience it and carry it through. The change must indeed begin with an individual. It might be any one of us. Nobody can afford to look around and to wait for somebody else to do what he is loath to do himself. But since nobody seems to know what to do, it might be worthwhile for each of us to ask himself whether by any chance his or her unconscious may know something that will help us. Certainly the conscious mind seems unable to do anything useful in this respect. Man today is painfully aware of the fact that neither his great religions nor his various philosophies seem to provide him with those powerful animating ideas that would give him the security he needs in face of the present condition of the world. I know what the Buddhists would say. Things would go right if people would only follow the noble eightfold path of the Dharma, doctrine, law, and had true insight into the self. The Christian tells us that if only people had faith in God, we should have a better world. The rationalist insists that if people were intelligent and reasonable, all our problems would be manageable. The trouble is that none of them manages to solve these problems himself. Christians often ask why God does not speak to them, as he is believed to have done in former days. When I hear such questions, it always makes me think of the rabbi who was asked how it could be that God often showed himself to people in the olden days, whereas nowadays nobody ever sees him. The rabbi replied, "Nowadays there is no longer anybody who can bow low enough." This answer hits the nail on the head. We are so captivated by and entangled in our subjective consciousness that we have forgotten the age-old fact that God speaks chiefly through dreams and visions. The Buddhist discards the world of unconscious fantasies as useless illusions. The Christian puts his church and his Bible between himself and his unconscious. And the rational intellectual does not yet know that his consciousness is not his total psyche. This ignorance persists today in spite of the fact that for more than 70 years, the unconscious has been a basic scientific concept that is indispensable to any serious psychological investigation. We can no longer afford to be so God Almighty-like as to set ourselves up as judges of the merits or demerits of natural phenomena. We do not base our botany upon the old-fashioned division into useful and useless plants, or our zoology upon the naive distinction between harmless and dangerous animals. But we still complacently assume that consciousness is sense and the unconscious is nonsense. In science, such an assumption would be laughed out of court. Do microbes, for instance, make sense or nonsense? Whatever the unconscious may be, it is a natural phenomenon, producing symbols that prove to be meaningful. We cannot expect someone who has never looked through a microscope to be an authority on microbes. In the same way, no one who has not made a serious study of natural symbols can be considered a competent judge in this matter. But the general undervaluation of the human soul is so great that neither the great religions, nor the philosophies, nor scientific rationalism have been willing to look at it twice. In spite of the fact that the Catholic Church admits the occurrence of somnia a Deo missa, dreams sent by God, most of its thinkers make no serious attempt to understand dreams. I doubt whether there is a Protestant treatise or doctrine that would stoop so low as to admit the possibility that the Vox Dei might be perceived in a dream. But if a theologian really believes in God, by what authority does he suggest that God is unable to speak through dreams? I have spent more than half a century in investigating natural symbols, and I have come to the conclusion that dreams and their symbols are not stupid and meaningless. On the contrary, dreams provide the most interesting information for those who take the trouble to understand their symbols. The results, it is true, have little to do with such worldly concerns as buying and selling, but the meaning of life is not exhaustively explained by one's business life, nor is the deep desire of the human heart answered by a bank account. In a period of human history when all available energy is spent in the investigation of nature, very little attention is paid to the essence of man, which is his psyche, although many researches are made into its conscious functions. But the really complex and unfamiliar part of the mind, from which symbols are produced, is still virtually unexplored. It seems almost incredible that though we receive signals from it every night, deciphering these communications seems too tedious for any but a very few people to be bothered with it. Man's greatest instrument, his psyche, is little thought of, and it is often directly mistrusted and despised. Its only psychological too often means it is nothing. Where exactly does this immense prejudice come from? We have obviously been so busy with the question of what we think that we entirely forget to ask what the unconscious psyche thinks about us. The ideas of Sigmund Freud confirmed for most people the existing contempt for the psyche. Before him, it had been merely overlooked and neglected. It has now become a dump for moral refuse. This modern standpoint is surely one-sided and unjust. It does not even accord with the known facts. Our actual knowledge of the unconscious shows that it is a natural phenomenon, and that, like nature herself, is at least neutral. It contains all aspects of human nature, light and dark, beautiful and ugly, good and evil, profound and silly. The study of individual as well as of collective symbolism is an enormous task, and one that has not yet been mastered. But a beginning has been made at last. The early results are encouraging, and they seem to indicate an answer to many so far unanswered questions of present-day mankind. Photo captions. The entrance to the tomb of the Egyptian pharaoh, Ramesses III. Left. Three of the four evangelists in a relief on Chartres Cathedral appear as animals. The lion is Mark, the ox, Luke, the eagle, John. Also, animals are three of the sons of the Egyptian god Horus, above, circa 1250 BC. Animals, and groups of four, are universal religious symbols. In many societies, representations of the sun express man's indefinable religious experience. Above, a decoration on the back of a throne belonging to the 14th century BC Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun is dominated by a sun disk. The hands at the end of the rays symbolize the sun's life-giving power. Left, a monk in 20th century Japan prays before a mirror that represents the divine sun in the Shinto religion. Right, tungsten atoms seen with a microscope that magnifies 2 million times. Far right, the spots in center of picture are the farthest visible galaxies. No matter how far man extends his senses, limits to his conscious perception remain. Dissociation means a splitting in the psyche, causing a neurosis. A famous fictional example of this state is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, 1886, by the Scots author R.L. Stevenson. In the story, Jekyll's split took the form of a physical change, rather than, as in reality, an inner psychic state. Left, Mr. Hyde, from the 1932 film of the story, Jekyll's other half. Primitive people call dissociation loss of a soul. They believe that a man has a bush soul as well as his own. Right, a Nyanga tribesman of West Central Africa wearing a mask of the hornbill, the bird that he identifies with his bush soul. Far right, telephonists on a busy switchboard handle many calls at once. In such jobs, people split off parts of their conscious minds to concentrate. But this split is controlled and temporary, not a spontaneous, abnormal dissociation. Left. Many of the great pioneers of modern psychoanalysis, photographed at a congress of psychoanalysis in 1911 at Weimar, Germany. The key, below left, identifies some of the major figures. 1. Sigmund Freud, Vienna. 2. Otto Ronck, Vienna. 3. Ludwig Binswanger, Kreuzlingen. 4. A. A. Brill. 5. Max Eitingon, Berlin. 6. James J. Putnam, Boston. 7. Ernest Jones, Toronto. 8. Wilhelm Stekel, Vienna. 9. Eugen Bleuler, Zurich. 10. Emma Jung, Küsnacht. 11. Sándor Ferenczi, Budapest. 12. C. G. Jung, Küsnacht. Right. The inkblot test, devised by the Swiss psychiatrist Hermann Rorschach. The shape of the blot can serve as a stimulus for free association. In fact, almost any irregular free shape can spark off the associative process. Leonardo da Vinci wrote in his notebooks, "It should not be hard for you to stop sometimes and look into the stains of walls, or ashes of a fire, or clouds, or mud, or like places in which you may find really marvelous ideas." Two different possible stimuli of free association. The whirling prayer wheel of a Tibetan beggar, left, or a fortune teller's crystal ball, right, a modern crystal gazer at a British fair. One of the countless symbolic or allegorical images of the sexual act is a deer hunt. Right, a detail from a painting by the 16th century German artist Cranach. The sexual implication of the deer hunt is underlined by a medieval English folk song called The Keeper. The first doe that he shot at he missed, and the second doe he trimmed he kissed, and the third ran away in a young man's heart. She's amongst the leaves of the greenough. A key in a lock may be a sexual symbol, but not invariably. Left, a section of an altarpiece by the 15th century Flemish artist Campin. The door was intended to symbolize hope, the lock to symbolize charity, and the key to symbolize the desire for God. Below, a British bishop, during the consecration of a church, carries out a traditional ceremony by knocking on the church door with a staff, which is obviously not a phallic symbol, but a symbol of authority and the shepherd's crook. No individual symbolic image can be said to have a dogmatically fixed, generalized meaning. The anima is the female element in the male unconscious. It and the animus in the female unconscious are discussed in Chapter 3. This inner duality is often symbolized by a hermaphroditic figure, like the crowned hermaphrodite above right from a 17th century alchemical manuscript. Right, a physical image of man's psychic bisexuality, a human cell with its chromosomes. All organisms have two sets of chromosomes, one from each parent. Misoneism, an unreasoning fear and hatred of new ideas, was a major block to public acceptance of modern psychology. It also opposed Darwin's theories of evolution, as when an American schoolteacher named Scopes was tried in 1925 for teaching evolution. Far left, at the trial, the lawyer Clarence Darrow defending Scopes. Center left, Scopes himself. Equally anti-Darwin is the cartoon, left, from an 1861 issue of Britain's magazine Punch. Right, a light-hearted look at misoneism by the American humorist James Thurber, whose aunt, he wrote, was afraid that electricity was leaking all over the place. In cases of extreme mass hysteria, which was in the past called possession, the conscious mind and ordinary sense perception seem eclipsed. Left. The frenzy of a Balinese sword dance causes the dancers to fall into trances, and sometimes to turn their weapons against themselves. Right. Rock and roll music, in its heyday, seemed to induce an almost comparable trance-like excitement. Among primitives, possession implies that a god or demon has taken over a human body. Above left, a Haitian woman collapses in a religious ecstasy. Above, center and right, Haitians possessed by the god Jeda, who is invariably manifested in this position, legs crossed, cigarette in mouth. Left, a religious cult in Tennessee, USA, today, whose ceremonies include the handling of poisonous snakes. Hysteria is induced by music, singing, and hand clapping. Then the people pass the snakes from hand to hand. Sometimes participants are fatally bitten. The toy cars, forming the Volkswagen trademark in this advertisement, may have a trigger effect on a reader's mind, stirring unconscious memories of childhood. If these memories are pleasant, the pleasure may be associated unconsciously with the product and brand name. The 19th century German chemist Kekulé, researching into the molecular structure of benzene, dreamed of a snake with its tail in its mouth. This is an age-old symbol. Left, a representation of it from a 3rd century BC Greek manuscript. He interpreted the dream to mean that the structure was a closed carbon ring, as on the page, far left, from his Textbook of Organic Chemistry, 1861. Right. An ordinary European highway with a familiar sign that means look out for animals crossing. But the motorists, their shadows appear in the foreground as they leave their car, see an elephant, a rhinoceros, even a dinosaur. This painting of a dream by the modern Swiss artist Erhard Jacobi accurately depicts the apparently illogical, incoherent nature of dream imagery. On these pages, further examples of the irrational, fantastic nature of dreams. Above left, owls and bats swarm over a dreaming man in an etching by the 18th century Spanish artist Goya. Dragons or similar monsters are common dream images. Left, a dragon pursues a dreamer in a woodcut from The Dream of Polyphilo, a fantasy written by a 15th